Thank you for coming. This is Dennis Feeves. He's presenting on Who You Calling Crazy, which history of mental illness and mental illness treatment. Mm-hmm. Thank you for coming. And
I want to thank you for coming, and I want to thank Aaron and the Probate Library for having me. I love having people in front of me. It's so much more energizing than just an empty screen.
Yeah.
So obviously you've seen the title and you've seen the famous Munch painting, which is the screen.
Yeah.
Let's start with Nathaniel Lee. Now, he was a very minor playwright in the 1660s and died of being dissipated. He drank himself to death. But I called them mad and they called me mad. And damn them, they outvoted me. And I thought that was a good way to start, because there is an ambiguity about what is madness, right? For example, is there mental illness? That's a legitimate question to ask, right? Well, there are contemporary critics of the diagnosis of mental illness. One is Michael Foucault. Now, Michael Foucault has no medical training. He's a philosopher, which of course qualifies him to talk about anything. And he argues that mental illness is just a cultural artifact. It's made up to suit the needs of some people in society. And he said that the rise of absolutism, that is, you can think of it as the rise of kings having great power, that really encouraged the notion of people being mentally ill, because those in power could say, well, that person's crazy, lock them up. Mm-hmm. So that is what Foucault argued. Thomas Sasz has the advantage of actually being a psychiatrist himself, that is, he has training. He just happens to dislike the entire rest of his profession. And he argues that mental illness is a man-made myth. Psychiatry is a pseudoscience like astrology or alchemy. Society.
When was he around? Is he current or?
Yeah, he's still alive, to the best of my knowledge, although he's probably pushing 90. Society manufactured mental illness to deal with social pests, oddballs, for example, like himself, or the challenging people that we run into. So that's one point of view. There are others. Richard Hunter and Ida McAlpine said, look at it. There is no objective method of describing findings without subjective interpretation, okay? And that's true. There's no exact and uniform terminology, partly because, just like in early medicine, psychiatrists and psychologists are sort of making this up as they go along. Mm-hmm. You know, it was not so long ago that medicine wasn't particularly discrete in terms of the diseases. In fact, do we have many more diseases today than they had 200 years ago? That's because we know more about physiology, right, than they did 200 years mm-hmm. ago. So there is a steady flow of new terms and ever-changing nomenclature. That's true, but I think there are reasons for that. And the etiology, that is, the causes of various forms of mental illness, is speculative, as it was for ague 150, 200 years ago. So, and the pathogenesis, the mechanism of the disease, is largely obscure. But does that recognize the fact that there is no such thing as mental illness? Or we know very little still? And it's up for debate. Now, there are those that argue that mental illness is the reality. Martin Roth, author of The Reality of Mental Illness, that shows you his bias, I think, right off the bat. The stability of psychiatric symptoms over time shows that it is a real psychopathological entity with an authentic, organic basis. Could be. So, now, are you familiar with the DSM, the diagnostic? That is the Bible. So when it was first published in 1952, it was 145 pages long. It's grown some since then. In 2022, the DSM, I think it's DSM-5, The fifth version is 947 pages, which may mean, just like in terms of biological medicine, are they getting better at diagnosis? Well, and that really was the key around 1900, when medicine globally began to be more scientific. They got better and better at diagnosis, not necessarily cures, but before you can cure, you have to know what it is you're treating, right? Okay, so it's estimated that 1-2% of the population will suffer from schizophrenia or bipolar. I trained myself to say bipolar, and then I heard someone on the radio this morning describe it as schizophrenia. So take your choice.
Well, they mean the same thing?
Yeah.
Really?
They, yeah.
And isn't, so. don't they think that or know that schizophrenia is genetic?
There seems to be a genetic component. Mm-hmm. That is, if you come from a certain family background, you are more likely. But more likely is, you know, it's like Lou Gehrig's disease. Mm-hmm. Certain background, you know, there are physiological things that are genetic too. 20% at some point or another will suffer from major depression. And I would have if you hadn't showed up, so I appreciate it. So, now, what I think is interesting is that numbers like this are lower in poor countries. And I think it means that poor countries cannot afford sick people.
Yeah, they'd have to take care of them.
We can afford sick people. There are enough relatively well-off Americans that they can go and say, I think that there's something wrong. In other societies, you know, so what? There's something wrong with everybody. Go back to work. Now, here are skulls about 5,000 years old. What do you notice about them that may be a little different?
The holes.
The holes, yes. Yeah. That, skulls have holes, but not in these places. Mm-hmm. And these, look at the holes. They are drilled in. Mm-hmm. Now, frequently, people ask me, why? And I don't know. No one knows for sure. You have any guesses?
Relieving pressure?
Possibly. You know, very often people say, there are these demons in my head. Well, what's the logical treatment? Let the little buggers out.
How about that condition of hydrocephaly or whatever?
Well, that could be. I mean, but notice, I think there's a start of a fourth here, I think. So, you know, whatever it is, it didn't work the first or the second or maybe the third time. And these are very, Jericho, of course, is in the Middle East. This is in Mexico. So this was a treatment called trepanning that widely spaced. Hmm. Now, let's look a little bit at madness in the ancient world. Each civilization, early civilization, saw madness as supernaturally inflicted. Healing, therefore, was trusted to priest doctors. Actually, in these societies, early societies, virtually everything was trusted to priest, whatever, priest economists, priest doctors, priest this. Mm-hmm. So
is the priest doctor and the witch doctor the same thing?
Yeah, I prefer, you know, witch doctor is a little a negative in its as it's been used. Okay. Except in one of my favorite songs from the 50s.
Yeah, I think it's going through my head right now.
Okay, yeah, well, you brought it up, so it's your fault. In the Old Testament, the Lord will smite thee with madness. By the way, the word madness in the Old Testament sort of argues against the fact that it's all a modern construct, right?
Yeah.
Anyway, ancient Egypt is interesting. The priest would induce, possibly through opium, a dream-filled incubation sleep. So they would put you to sleep, probably with opium, and then the patient would tell dreams to the priest who would interpret them. Didn't know Freud was an Egyptian, did you? Anyway, the Babylonians, physical and mental illness caused by demons. Okay, and again, that's very often the idea. So you had to have the right ritual performed by a priest, and that would have a cleansing impact. Now, the ancient Greeks, physical cleansing is necessary. So they might give you an internal purge. That is, they would give you something to make you vomit or loosen your bowels, or both, if you were very lucky. You'd be given a hallucinatory drink and led through a labyrinth. Patients would see visions. They would hear the voice of God. And sometimes it appears they would be cured. Or at the Temple of Delphi, they would suspend you over a pit of hissing, saying, I don't know about you, but it would cure me. Yeah, I'm fine. I'm just fine. Uh-huh. Plato, the Greek philosopher, said that the causes would be a bodily disease, something physical, an imbalance of base emotions. The Greeks like to talk about elevated emotions and base emotions. Base emotions like anger, fear, jealousy, lust, or the intervention of gods. The gods would destroy, they first make man. So you have to restore the patient's body and the soul to harmony. And if you think about it, that's really what cures, right? I mean, it really does. How you do that is where it gets difficult. If a man is man, he shall not be at large in the city, but his family, lucky them, shall keep him in any way they can. So that's what he said.
Those are scary words.
Hmm?
Those are scary
words. Oh, yeah, words. Sure. I mean, I don't mean.
Right, and what do they do to control the people?
So Hippocrates was, of course, one of the great ancient world doctors. Now, when I say he was great, I don't mean he was effective, but he was widely read and widely appreciated. Men ought to know that from the brain, and from the brain alone, arises our pleasures, joys, laughter, and jests, as well as our sorrows, pains, griefs, and tears, which is, I think, essentially true, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
It's from the brain that we have those. In another section, mental illness is caused by an imbalance of the four humors. Have you heard of the humors? It was viewed that the body was governed by four humors. There was blood, which you understand, black bile, which was solid matter, okay? Yellow bile, urine, and phlegm, okay? And that somehow these had to keep in balance. And of course, if you were ill, they would try and bring them in balance, for example, by bleeding you or purging you, or, you know, no matter what it was generally disgusting what they did to you. And generally, it didn't help at all. All right. So let's move up to medieval Europe, because abnormality commonly diagnosed as supernatural. And you know, if you were unusual, it was either divinely inspired or by Satan. So but there was a supernatural source. Insanity was deeply shameful to a family on account of its overtones of diabolical possession or bad stock. And, you know, really, I say that it's not more than about 50 years, even in this country, that it hasn't been deeply shameful. And I think under some circumstances, it still is.
Mm-hmm.
So this was not unusual. So there was a lot of witch and heretic hunting. This was associated with madness. You see that at least 2,000 people, largely my audience. Well, you know, what can I tell you? But, you know, they were easy to pick on. They were powerless in their societies. And there was no one to defend them, and they didn't have enough power to defend themselves. Now, although, you know, all of these witch burnings and so forth ultimately led to official skepticism that they were possessed by demons, you know, but a lot of good it did. So those who were defined as witches would be treated by priests. They would use various cures, holy relics, you know, and so on and so forth, which weren't as effective, I think, as you would hope. In port towns, the city officials would just take this poor woman and get a ship captain to take her someplace else. Well, you know, and that's if he was honest. I mean, he could just take her out and
kill
her, drop it. in the sea. Mm-hmm. But, you know, can you imagine that? I mean, this is obviously this is a person already distressed, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And then to be dropped down penniless in a strange place where people maybe don't even speak the same language as you do, it would be horrible. Yeah, no wonder they were crazy. You'll like this one. Now, James I of England thought that a pond or a river would refuse to take a witch. So his solution to determine whether or not they were a witch was to bind them up, tie up their hands and feet, and then throw them in. If they float, they're guilty, because if you have your arms and feet bound together, should you be able to float? No. Of course, if they sink, they're innocent, but then you have another problem.
They're also dead.
Well, but they've been proven innocent. one thing is they could be buried in hollow ground. As a witch, you couldn't be buried in sacred ground. But Maleficarum, the Hammer of Witches. This was a book by these two gentlemen, and it told the reader how to recognize witches, not by the pointy hats, methods to make them confess, because we all know that confession is good for the soul, right? It depends on what they have to do to get you to confess, I think. And anyone, especially any woman who talked wildly, wandered aimlessly, and insisted she heard strange voices, was likely to be a witch. What a major star, novels. Okay, so now, they, in Europe, they began in the 1400s to confine mental patients. And you see here that they used facilities designed for paupers or army or navy casualties. These were horrible places, even for the veterans. You know, we'd say these would be VA hospitals, but these were horrible, horrible places. Because you're a hero when the war is going on, and when the war is over, who cares? You won. Good. Congratulations. You're on your own.
No, yeah, it's not.
You know, so they're really put in some of the most desperate circumstances imaginable. Now, the great confinement amounted to a debasement of madness. You know, they were getting them out of sight, I think. They were just getting them out of sight, and that was enough. Hitherto, the mad exhibited the force of the fascination, be it as the holy fool, witch, or a man possessed. They could mock their betters. You know, very often, kings would have fools as part of their court. And because they were fools, they could say anything, because it's foolish, right? So they could say some pretty pointed things, even to the king, about his policies or his activities or his character. But here, we're just saying, they're crazy, get them out of sight. So, you know, and some say institutionalization was really a negation. It was saying that they're not really, they're not truly human like you and I. Now, this is going to come as a great surprise to you, but it was largely women who suffered this. Women were especially prone to nervous complaint. If you're wondering what that is, nervous vapors arise from the uterus, deranging the female brain. Fathers and husbands should protect women from excitement that could bring on such vapors. Wow. Well, I'm glad it's that simple. Lower class women, by the way, were just crazy. You know, this is only if you are wealthy enough to be indulged. This is not for everyone. You ever hear of Bedlam? Okay. Well, it's after a hospital in London, St. Mary's of Bethlehem, and Bethlehem became contracted to Bedlam. It is the oldest psychiatric hospital in the world. It still exists, not in the original building, but it still exists. It was established in 1403. And the position of the administrator at first was a sinecure. Now, sinecure is one of those technical words that means you have the job, but you can use it to make money. How on earth could you make money running a mental hospital? Well, you could charge people to look at the crazy folks. Want to see someone really nuts? Come on. You got a penny? I remember this is an English penny. and it was worth a lot more than the merit. But is there so great merit and dexterity in being a mad doctor? The common prescriptions of Bethlehem medical doctor are a purge and a vomit and a vomit and a purge over again, and sometimes bleeding, which is no great mystery. That is, this author is saying, this is all ridiculous. And so, and what did it look like? I thought you might enjoy, well, I thought you'd find useful some pictures from the era of what it may look like. You see, for example, this gentleman. You can see the gentleman there. You can see the nice ladies looking at the crazy people. Look at the man with the collar around his neck and the chain attached to the pole. I mean, they treated these people very harshly. Now, because of the theory of the four humors, if we talked about earlier, the patients would be bled. They'd be given purges, which I'm sure calmed them down right away. Maniacs would be strapped in a chair, and ice water would cascade on their heads. Feeling better already, aren't you? The theory was that men had become beasts. So mad doctors, as they were called then, advised that patients needed to be tamed, beaten, tied to chairs. They were beasts. And so like beasts, you would have to break them the way you would break a horse. How'd you do that? Well, I like this one. This is a specific invention to try and restore your sanity. It's the spinning chair. I mean, you see the poor man was strapped in the chair and then they spin around and around and around, which wouldn't take me more than 4 or 5 turns and I'd be throwing up. But you see, he seems pretty cheerful about it because he's not spinning. It begins to change with this man, Philippe Pinel. He was made director of the Salpêtrière and by Bicêtre Hospital in Paris. In 1793, it's interesting, 1793 is the high point of the terror. And so here is a lot of bloodletting going on in Paris, and this man is made head of the mad hospital. One of the first things he did was unchain the patients. Right there, is that progress? I'm sure the patients felt so. He insisted that they be treated humanely, that these were human beings, not beasts to be broken. The treatment, he said, what we need to do is try to manage their minds. Now, he wasn't sure how to do that, but remember, he's inventing this as he goes along. And as an example, he had one patient who had a deadly fear that he was going to be guillotined. So they staged a mock trial, and he wasn't guillotined, and apparently he was cured. Now, Pinel is also the invention of this device. This is the cardigan that ties in the back, you know, or what we call the straitjacket. Okay. On the other hand, this is probably better than the chains. I mean, you know, I'm not saying this is great, but I'm saying even this, I think, is progress. You know, you can put him in a straitjacket or you can let the guards beat him. So a little after this, there is another breakthrough, the notion of moral treatment. This is the work of William Tuke. He is an English Quaker, and the Quakers play a very important role in what's going to take place. Tuke and the other Quakers who supported him argued that madness in part is a result of biological disease in body or brain. And we can accept that. Not all psychological disease, but some. Therefore, we need lunatic asylums, a term we wouldn't use anymore, where they can convalesce. If they are sick, they need to get better at convalesce. So they established in Northern England the York Asylum, later known as the York Retreat. And the therapy there was to try and appeal to the inmates' desire to be normal. They had the notion that everyone wants to behave, wants to be part of society, wants to be accepted, which I think is largely true, and urged them to regain their powers of reason, See any beating or putting them in spinning chairs or dumping ice water on there? We'll go back to the ice water, by the way. So no rotary machines here, none of that spinning stuff. And they are unrestrained. And as part of the therapy, work was a key ingredient. It was the responsibility of the patients to tend the grounds, and this had significant grounds around it. So they had a very disciplined life. There was a strict daily routine. That daily routine included work. It included meals together. It included, you know, a lot of socialization.
They're getting fresh air. They're getting exercise and all.
Well,
that.
You know, probably better than locking them up in bedlam.
Yeah, it would be a help to them.
Yeah. So the York Quakers put their patients first. They perceived patients had a God-given capacity for recovery, and they tried to assist nature in helping them heal. But the York Quakers were willing to accept that many brethren would continue in their crazy ways. They would provide a refuge for those who could not regain their mental health. So their notion was, you know, if we can't cure them, we still have a responsibility to care for them, which I think is a huge moral breakthrough, that we have a responsibility. I certainly wish we felt that way. You'll hear my other prejudices on these lines today. Now, moral treatment in the United States was again inspired by the Quakers. The very first asylum opened in Philadelphia by the Quakers. This is what, about 23 years after the York Asylum. So then in 1818, the Congregationalists, not wanting the Quakers to get ahead of them, opened their own asylum in McLean Hospital. And the first public asylum, now these are private institutions, the first public asylum opened in 1833. So these are the first.
And where was that one in?
Oh, you know, I looked at that and I said, I hope no one asked me where that was.
I could look it up.
Would you believe Massachusetts? Oh, Massachusetts. Then I can say with
the. So you're already talking Boston up there.
Yeah. It may have been Pennsylvania.
One or the other.
Yeah. But anyway, so this is a public institution. By 1841, there were 16 public and private asylums in the United States. So there is some growth, some expansion. There is a growing realization that we need to do something for these folks. Another key figure in this progress is this man, Thomas Kirkbride. In 1840, he became superintendent of the Pennsylvania Hospital for the Insane. And he believed that patients could, through the exercise of their free will, choose to be saved. They could resist their mad thoughts and fight off their attacks of depression and mania. So that is his basic philosophy, that the patients can cure themselves. We need to give them the time, the opportunity, the place to do that. And in fact, in the 1800s, more than 50% of the newly insane, I take that to mean recent people committed to the asylum, 50% were discharged within a year, which isn't too bad. Now, and 58 of them never came back, 58% of the 50%. So we can say that probably at least a quarter using this therapy were cured. I mean, it's, you know, they were as free to go in society as you and I are. So again, you see a difference in terms of the emphasis and the way they want to treat these folks. He also believed that they should live in attractive surroundings. The Kirkbride plan now had very, very elaborate hospitals, you can see here, standardized facilities. This one happens to be the Eastern Michigan Asylum. You'll see more of that. What used to be called the Pontiac Asylum for the Insane or something like that, or Clinton Valley in Oakland County. So it housed patients in attractive surroundings. And there were beginning to be some attention by important writers. One of the most important would be Dorothea Dix, After she had some mental problems, and in fact, I think she went to the York Asylum. And after a year-long convalescence in England, returned to Massachusetts to investigate conditions for the poor insane. Want to guess what they were like?
Real awesome.
Very good. Yeah. I proceed, gentlemen, briefly to call your attention to the present state of insane persons confined within this commonwealth in cages, stalls, pens, chained, naked, beaten with rods, and lashed into obedience. That sounds like that'll work. So she traveled nationwide, campaigning on behalf of the poor insane. And this had an effect. I mean, it did have an effect. So there was a new effort. There was a nationwide building spree of mental hospitals using the Kirkbride plan, which we saw earlier. In 1840, there were about 18 public hospitals for the insane. By 1880, there were 139. The new state hospitals were often palatial buildings with high ceilings, lofty windows, and space and fresh air, along with exercise and a varied diet. And this is the Eastern Michigan Asylum, that's the one at the Pontiac State Hospital. And that's an early picture of it. Here's another sketch. And the first director of that asylum was Henry Hurd. He's the first superintendent there from 1878 to 1889. And he really, again, is trying to bring science into this and, in fact, create people who have some training in treating those who have mental illness. So he introduces modern antiseptic procedures. Now, of course, we've all learned to wash our hands repeatedly over the past couple of years, right? But such a thing was a breakthrough. This was a breakthrough. Joseph Lister, and you probably heard of Listerine, right? He was the one who brought antisepsis into medicine. I think that was 1878. In fact, when President Garfield was shot, Lister was one of the people brought there. He said, look, before you probe to try and find the bullet, you have to, because doctors were getting on their surreys, you know, with the reins, which had probably dragged in the street at some point, and you, okay, you know, and they didn't necessarily have gloves on, and they would walk up to him and start poking their fingers in the wound.
They didn't have wipes and all those kinds of things.
No, they didn't have wipes. No, not at all. Not at all. And they probably gave Garfield the infections that killed him. So he was killed by medicine. Although Lister tried to encourage them to, why don't you wash your hands? What harm could it be? Anyway. Mm-hmm. It just seems so.
Now, were these superintendents tend to be doctors or?
Yeah, he wasn't a doctor. So he was looking for uniform classifications. Let's try and put people in category. I mean, as much as we can. They had patient histories and maintained records. So you could, in effect, chart progress. He had standardized statistical methods for analyzing patients. He wanted trained nurses and attendants. He didn't think he could bring anyone off the street and make them an attendant there. And he wanted young doctors to rotate through the hospital so they'd have some experience with the mentally ill. Sounds perfectly reasonable, doesn't it? So here's the Eastern Michigan Asylum. August 1st, 1878 is when it opened. 121 men and 100 women from the asylum in Kalamazoo were transferred to Eastern Michigan. Elijah Myers, by the way, was the architect. He also designed the state capitol in Michigan. So, you know, you can see they didn't fool around looking for the lowest possible bid. And by 1955, those buildings were around in the 1970s, I can remember the 1980s. They had 3,100 patients. And we'll talk about the patient loads and what that means in a bit. Now, the new hospitals, as you saw, compared to what went on before, were vast. They covered hundreds of acres. The hospital in Pontiac covered, I think, 700 acres. You know, almost, well, a little more than a square mile. if you know that area at all, where the old Pontiac Mall would be, that was part of the hospital grounds. In fact, they found clay beds there that they used that clay to make the bricks for the hospital. They were made on the grounds. Patients worked as a therapy, and it cut down on cost. Yes, it did save on cost, but you know, they were growing their own food. You know, it was pretty healthy. Many employees lived on the grounds, so obviously did the employees working with these patients find them terribly dangerous? You wouldn't live on the grounds if you did. And just some photographs of other state hospitals of this year. Here's Buffalo State. Isn't that beautiful? Fairfield State Hospital.
Yeah, that is. Where's that? Fairfield?
Connecticut.
Oh, okay.
This is in New York.
Yeah, I know where Utica is.
It's Northern Michigan. In Traverse City, right? Mm-hmm. This has been reconditioned into yuppie buildings and apartments. Mm-hmm. Yeah. This was the state mental hospital in Wayne County. This is Danvers State Hospital, again in New York. This is the Willard Asylum in Seneca Lake, New York. Here is some art done by patients.
Aww.
On the wall. That's sweet. What's happened is these buildings have been abandoned, and you can see damage. Here's another one. Very sweet. So these folks had skills.
I love that.
Yeah, I thought you might appreciate it. Look at this theater that was part of one of the state hospitals. Mm-hmm. Now the asbestos curtain is problematic, but they didn't know that then. But imagine that theater. And of course, now we can have straitjackets in a variety of colors. So as an example, and this was largely true of the other hospitals, there was farmland, there were greenhouses, dairy barns. In fact, at the Eastern Michigan Asylum, they had herds of cattle there that regularly produced winners at the state fair. So they were very good at what they were doing. Chicken houses, piggeries, and you look at this, and what it means is a pretty well balanced diet. The shops made clothing, and of course, this is going to give them skills that are marketable if and when they're discharged. So, clothing, shoes, baskets.
Is this in the 1900s here we're talking, or what is?
We're talking about the late 1800s. Actually, things will start going sour in the 1900s.
Okay.
Unfortunately.
Yeah, because this sounds like you kind of get back to the land type thing.
Right. They work the power plant, clean wards and offices, staff the superintendent's home. You know, they cook for the superintendent and so on. Now, again, there are those who would say, but this is exploiting. But, you know, maybe. I mean, it could be. It certainly could be, right? But it's also giving them purpose.
Was it free for them to stay at these places?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, these people are penniless for the most part. And patients were classified by their ability to work. Now, to be of service, the form of occupation selected for the patient at first must be recreative by furnishing relief from the morbid trains of thought. After convalescence is established, former habits of occupation may, with advantage, be gradually resumed. So, you know, first we're going to try and get them to relax, right? And then we will try and make sure they have an effective set of skills. Now, the problem is these things tend to work.
Yeah, that sounds pretty good there.
Yeah, I think it's the way we ought to treat people who need that help today.
Yeah, perfect.
To be perfectly frank. But what happens is these hospitals were successful. And so as they built these asylums, cities and counties who had all sorts of charges that they were taking care of started dumping all these people into the mental health system. They were the elderly, the syphilitic, those in end-stage dementia, those with incurable neurological disorders, all of these. So, oh, we have an asylum? Hey, you're going to the asylum.
Yes.
Now, again, in part, it's the hospitals weren't intended or designed to help, for example, a syphilitic or someone with end-stage dementia or incurable.
There was nowhere else
they were
for them.
That's not what they were designed to do. But what's happened is you see that cities and counties are getting them off their responsibility. They no longer have to pay to do something with these people.
Mm-hmm.
And so discharge rates fall because they are having so many people who are incurable. I mean, and the hospitals grew very, very large. The Clinton Valley Center, Pontiac State Hospital, 3,100 people. That's a large, large number of people. Okay. So Americans like nothing better than the quick fix, right? We want to fix the problem. We want to do it quickly, and we want to do it cheaply. You could make a good industry. Yeah. So one of the solutions was hydrotherapy, hence all of these strange bathtubs. The patient was straitjacketed, which I'm sure helped. And then they were placed in a tub in a hammock-like sling. And then they filled the tub with water. It's often icy water. And they would keep the patient there for hours or perhaps even days.
That's like torture.
Well, how you feel? Better? Oh, undoubtedly better. Again, it's like the snake pit, right? We dangled you over the snake pit. You're feeling better? Oh, sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No problem for me. We also see that the future is also the past. And by that, I mean madness, some argue, was caused by untreated infection. So we have this particular doctor, Henry Cotton, who surgically removed what he considered to be the infected parts of patients, including teeth, tonsils, sinuses, gallbladder, appendix, thyroids, colon, fallopian tube, uterus, ovaries. You see, ladies, that you have more infected parts available than testicles. Well, you're not left out. But, you know,
yeah.
Now he claimed an 85% cure rate, but 43% of his patients died. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know if he considers death a cure, which I suppose in one sense it is. Others injected patients with animal extracts from ovaries, testicles, pituitary, and thyroids. People were being injected with extracts from this for all sorts of things, men for impotence and so on. Doesn't work, but you know, there is nothing so crazy that someone won't pay for it. Then there is pseudoscience. Francis Galton, who happened to be a cousin of Darwin, created something called social Darwinism. Now, this has really nothing to do with evolution as Darwin described it. This is a bastardized idea. That didn't stop it from being popular. The severely mentally ill were carriers of defective germplasm. That is, we would say today they had bad genes. So if it's in their sperm and their ovaries, what's the only reasonable thing to do? Well, make it illegal for the insane to marry and going to, you know, but that doesn't solve the problem completely, does it? So what we have to do is segregate them in asylums and release them only after they had been sterilized. Now, I'm making reference to a book you may find interesting. It's Annie's Ghost. It's by Steve Luxenberg. He grew up in the Detroit area, later became a top reporter for the Washington Post. And when his mother died, he found that he had an aunt he had never heard of, Annie, who had been defined as mentally ill and put in Eloise, the hospital you saw a picture of earlier. Mm-hmm. And it's really a wonderful story. If you like nonfiction, I almost exclusively read nonfiction. My wife almost exclusively reads fiction. And somehow we meet in the middle. Annie, who was probably retarded, was ostracized, considered defective. She can't get married. And the family finally put her in Eloise. And the book is the story of Luxembourg finding all of this out, trying to track down the records. Now, on this whole topic, Iowa passed a law saying criminals, rapists, idiots, feeble-minded, imbeciles, lunatics, drunkards, drug fiends, epileptics, syphilitics, moral and sexual perverts, whatever that is, and diseased and degenerate persons can be sterilized. Except most of us. takes up a lot of my friends anyway. In 1945, more than 45,000 people were sterilized in the United States. 21,000 of those, nearly half, were patients in state mental hospitals. Again, we're seeing people who cannot effectively refuse cannabis. And nearly 50% of those were in the state of California, which in 1945 was not the liberal paradise. Remember, it was the Californians who wanted those Japanese interred during the Second World War. Now,
I'm surprised to see epileptic. I mean, that you don't control that. I mean, it's like, that's crazy.
I understand. It's all crazy.
They didn't know they're epileptic at the time, though. They just had fits.
Yeah, but you know, but again, you could see that they, you know, it wasn't voluntary. You know, they weren't choosing to have. So the Third Reich, by the way, loved all of this and all of what was going on in America because it gave cover for their own programs. They were strong proponents of eugenics, remember, it was a Nestor race, and influenced by US laws and given cover by them. 1930 to 1940, 375,000 people were sterilized, and then Hitler in 39 created the Action 4 program. It was to kill the mentally and physically disabled. 275,000 people were starved, gassed, medicated to death. One of the nurses in the program, and I don't know how you could really call yourself a nurse and do this, but anyway, the Fuhrer developed a euthanasia law, which in consideration of the war was not to be published. It was absolutely voluntary for those present to agree to participate. She's talking about the doctors and nurses, not the victims. None of us had any objection to this program. And Blankenberg swore us in. We were sworn to secrecy and obedience. And Blankenberg called our attention to the fact that any violation of the oath would be punished by death.
That's awesome.
So, well, yeah. I mean, and look at the numbers. I mean, that's a significant number of people. And, you know, the families would get death certificates saying that they got the flu or something else.
The crack.
Now, remember, we're still looking for easy fixes, right? So let's look at the shocking theories. One attempt was to put people into an insulin coma near death for 20 minutes to up to 2 hours. This caused serious brain trauma. Put it simply, it screws up the wiring. And maybe you get out of that, maybe you don't. Metrazole induced convulsions that could fracture bones. Is that fairly serious? Convulsions, hair muscles, loosened teeth. But the crown jewel of this was electroshock therapy. First introduced by Ugo Cerletti and Lucio Bini in 1948, I think it was. They will get the Nobel Prize in Medicine for this.
Where are they from?
Italy. So again, putting an electric shock through the brain is, again, a form of severe trauma. We're not supposed to put electrodes on each side and shoot a charge through our brains. Very often it caused permanent brain damage, reduced learning capacity. And are you surprised that 70% of the patients were women?
No.
No. Second surprise. They don't know how it works, but they said it worked. Well, again, to me, it's like being dangled over this snake pit.
Just make them like a blob, probably. Like,
well, you want to have someone look like a blob? Let's look at the next one. Lobotomy. Egas Moniz in 1935 did the first lobotomy. He drilled a hole into the patient's skull and killed brain tissue with absolute alcohol. He claimed the more brain tissue that was damaged, the better were the results. Does that seem likely to you that we get better by, okay. Now, Walter Freeman and James Watts, Walter Freeman really becomes the major proponent in the United States of lobotomy therapy, if it can be called that. And he found a much easier way to do it by just using an ice pick. And I'll show you how he did it in a minute. You first gave, I like this, as a form of anesthesia, you first gave them an electric shock, which we already found out was not a good idea. And if the patient is resisting having this done to them, I think it's proof they're sane myself, but it was evidence that the patient was a good candidate for lobotomy. So you can force the eyeball back and insert the ice pick up, break through the brain pan, which is pretty thin. And then what he did was wiggle it around a little bit, in effect, slicing up the tissue. Slice, 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 slice. Doesn't that look terrible? 1945 to 55, there were 20,000 lobotomies in the US. It was, some call it a surgically induced childhood. Stockton State Hospital in New York used cheap, maybe California, chiefly to pacify noisy, assaulted, and uncooperative patients, because about 25% of discharge patients could be considered adjusting at the level of a domestic invalid or household pet. So we transform them into passive but nice dogs. And maybe the most notable case in the United States was Rosemary Kennedy, who was lobotomized at 23 and could scarcely speak after that, although she managed to live another 54 years. Yeah. But, you know, and it's because her father thought that she was intractable. And again, I hope you see a pattern here where it's men who are very often making these decisions that women are crazy. I'm not entirely proud of being a man all the time. So there was a serious decline with the coming of the Depression and the Second World War in state hospitals. 1900, there were 126,000 and 131 asylums. By 1940, you can see almost a tripling of the number of patients, but not even a 50% increase in the number of hospitals. 1900, one doctor per 175 patients, probably a little heavy on the patient side then. But look at 1943, it's one doctor for 274, and the nurse patient ratio is what the doctor's was 43 years earlier. In 1943, Pennsylvania attendants in the state hospital were paid $900 per year. Prison guards got $1,950. And who should probably have the greater set? Let's not even get into who has the greater set of skills. Let's assume the skills are equal. Should they have, and the responsibilities are equal? Should they have equal pay? So the state hospital, again, remember we saw this earlier, became dumping grounds for misfits, alcoholics, drug addicts, epileptics, vagrants, senile, elderly, syphilitics, social wastage, which is one of the uglier terms you'll ever hear. So hospitals were ignored, underfunded, overcrowded, understaffed, and not only were they understaffed, but the staff got low wages. Attendants maintained order with coercion, brute force, and restraints. And things don't get better when the war is over. And so there is a series of exposés as to what's going on in state hospitals across the United States. The Shame of the States by Albert Deutsch revealed appalling conditions. Naked men kept in bare rooms in their own feces, barefoot women in coarse tunics strapped to wooden benches, restrained patients having no use of hands, eating from tin plates like dogs. The mentally ill in such hospitals were guiltless patient prisoners, which I think is a reasonable term, a fair term for them, right? In New York, they accounted for a quarter of the state budget. Is that expensive? We need a quick fix, don't we? So we'll look for another quick fix. Can it be psychoanalysis? No. Psychoanalysis can work for some people, not for everyone, but it is slow. Mm-hmm. And it ain't cheap. Mm-hmm. So we're not going to do that for hundreds of thousands of people. So, and no guarantee of results. How about drugs? We love pills. So, seen as a cheap, quick way to treat patients and make them pliable, not cured, notice, pliable. So Henry Lederer developed Storazine. It calmed disturbed patients. There was a certain drowsiness, apathy, passivity, lack of motivation. But are they troublesome?
Is that the one where they like that would cause them to not would not have a limb or something? Or
no, I don't think so. So they sometimes did have tremors, facial twitches. It induced brain pathology in some of the patients, similar to Parkinson's. Patients were unwilling to give up their psychosis. They preferred being nuts to being on Thorazine.
Maybe it was the offspring of somebody who was given Thorazine.
I think you're thinking something.
That's thalidomide.
Yeah.
Oh. Okay.
That was thalidomide in the 60s.
Oh, okay.
And that was, what was that for? That wasn't for mental.
I believe it was for morning sickness.
I think you're right.
Okay.
Okay. So patients were shuffling like mindless automatons. So there are other drugs. One of them that seemed to be effective and still seems to be effective is lithium for bipolar patients. That seems to help them. I had a good friend who was on lithium for years, and she didn't have the same highs and lows that she had when she wasn't on lithium. I know that because sometimes she stopped taking it, and you go, oh, look at that.
Yeah.
It looked very exciting, but trying. So there were anti-anxiety drugs, Librium, Valium, Nilcom, what was known in the 70s as Mother's Little Helpers. Because, you know, don't set fire to the drugs here. When I was 13 women in the U.S. were using them, that's a high proportion. But I wonder if it reflects the social context in which these women lived. And of course, what's good for the manufacturers is they're habituated. So, given all of the terrible things we saw in the 40s, there became a mass movement for deinstitutionalization. There were the negative reports of conditions, and they were terrible. Medication seemed to control symptoms. Now, remember, controlling symptoms and curing people are not the same thing. Antipsychotic writings, such as our friend Thomas Sass, which you saw at the beginning, and the desire to reduce cost. I think this ought to be a very large letter. It's been probably at the top. In 1965, Medicaid changed to paying for nursing home care, but not inpatient psych care. Before, they were paying for inpatient psych care. Well, that was expensive. We can just put these folks in nursing homes, can't we? Well, not if you want to try to help them be cured, because nursing homes aren't going to have the skilled staff for that. And then in 1972, Social Security payments to the disabled, the state could discharge people to boarding homes and welfare hotels, and Social Security will pay for it. So we can empty the hospitals, right?
Mm-hmm.
We can empty the hospitals. And the Supreme Court gets in on all this. A state cannot constitutionally confine without treatment a non-dangerous individual who is capable of surviving safely in freedom by himself or with the help of willing and responsible family members and friends. Now, that's a wonderful sentiment. It assumes without treatment, you know, they need to be treated, right?
Mm-hmm.
It also assumes that they are capable of surviving safely. Do we know that's definite? And while they may have willing family and friends, let me ask you for how long. This can be exhausting. It can be exhausting. All they went on to say, the mere presence of mental illness does not disqualify a person from preferring his home to the comforts of an institution. I got a feeling that not anyone on that court knew someone who was crazy. Now, the response was, the patient advocates celebrated. Patients can't be forced to take medications. You can only hold a patient for 72 hours against their will. Hold longer only if you could demonstrate, and this is tough, that they are a danger to themselves or others. Mental health professionals, on the other hand, were appalled by this decision. Illness interferes with making rational choices. I mean, is that obvious?
Yeah.
A large number of patients have been kidnapped by a small number of lawyers in order to make a philosophical point on their own behalf. I understand the philosophy, but they're not looking at the needs, it seems to me, of the people who need help. We ought to insist that the hospitals help people, not to close the hospitals down. So, but we did. So, 55, more than 500,000 in state hospitals. 62, fell a bit, not terribly. 70, that's pretty serious decline. 1980, by two-thirds. And today, there are 13,579 psychiatric beds in the United States.
Be interesting to see the correlation between homelessness and that.
Well, absolutely. Absolutely. There's a strong correlation. So, in answer to the question, one estimate in 1993 is that 200,000 of those patients were in jail for loitering, panhandling, disturbing the peace. You know, and there's being a pain in the neck, and there's really disturbing the peace. And very often, I think these people are just annoying. But it's easier for the cops to arrest them than to explain to the person making the charge, well, you know, they're just being annoying. Yeah, come on. So my wife and I have a family policy. We keep in our cars $5 McDonald's cards.
Oh,
and if someone is asking,
panhandling or whatever,
we don't ask him, is he going to use this for, we're not going to give him a $5.
You don't give him cash. Yeah, that's what everybody
but
says.
But with that McDonald's card, they can get a meal, they can go in, use the bathroom, they can wash up.
That's
in the winter, they can get warm. And, you know, and the $5 isn't going to break us.
That's nice.
It, you know, but again, we try and live by our values, you know, and it's not the solution, but it's what we can do. So what the deinstitutionalization created, what you were saying, sidewalk psychotics. So they're wandering around. Now, there are clinics and halfway houses. Outpatient clinics are really for the, I like this, the worried well. You know, people with means will go to an outpatient clinic. So, and even these are inadequate numbers. Group homes are not sufficiently monitored. And I think that there are people who are very sincere trying to run effective group homes. But A, there's not enough of them, and not everyone. And there should be monitoring, no matter how sincere they are. There ought to be standards, and we ought to have people checking to make sure they're living up to the standards. Those with the greatest need are left to fend for themselves. Homeless shelters became refuges for thousands of patients in the 70s, like almshouses of the 19th century. These shelters became catch-all institutions for alcoholics, petty criminals, abuse victims, and people with severe mental illness. As one patient said, look, Bronx State is no picnic, but it is infinitely better than starving, freezing on the streets, or being knifed on the Bowery. The hospital, if nothing else, offered in a word, asylum. What a wonderful word that is. That's what a patient saw. So it boils down today to what are we willing to pay for? I know we're supposed to hate all taxes, but Supreme Court Justice, I'm not gonna worry about the name, said taxes buy me civilization. It buys our roads, it buys community, it funds this building and the staff and the books and speakers charging outrageous fees. So what are we willing to pay for to help these folks? The history of medicine is in effect the history of discarded therapies, and it's good that we've discarded those therapies because they weren't working. And then, if my heart could speak, I'm sure it would say, I wish I were someplace else today. Among these books, a great amount of knowledge there must be, but what good is knowledge where others carry the keys? Through the last 10 years, many improvements have been made, but the final words seem to say, don't forget, my good man, you're still a patient here today. Intelligence, ability, and knowledge surely will never last. Why, all we want to look at, my good man, is your past. I wish that some of these people who write the books and make the rules could spend just a few years walking in our shoes. Mm-hmm. And I think that's an effective way to end the program. Thank you very much for your attention.